Okay, so on the show today, we've got Maxim Jago, who has created quite a unique teaching system. So Maxim, tell us exactly what you've come up with and what you're able to offer people in the world of trainer training.
Okay, well, I've undergone a great deal of technical training and I've given a lot of technical training. And I found that as a student, I was mostly incredibly bored and had a great deal of difficulty maintaining my concentration. And like a lot of people who experience training, not just technical training, but any kind of training, they end up thinking, I'll read the notes, you know. And I remember my dad used to say, he used to get training all the time, he used to work for the government. And when he used to say every training course they went on was just an excuse to get out of the office, the very first question they'd ask the trainer is, will we be given notes? And as soon as the answer was yes, they'd just switch off because they knew it was going to be incredibly boring. And I'm sure everybody's had the experience of listening to a teacher who tells you the information that you're going to receive, and later you will find that I've gone to sleep already. So I got very bored receiving technical training, and I found as a teacher that giving kind of very dry technical information just doesn't work for people. And I started to look, I've spent about 10 years developing this system, teaching different subjects and trying things out and using my students as guinea pigs and experimenting. And what I found was that, it makes sense if you think about it, that the best way to teach people is to relate to them naturally, to allow them to think naturally, to behave naturally, to allow their thought processes to develop and grow naturally. So the famous German playwright Bertolt Brecht used to write about how you need a very, very small amount of information to create a story. Now, I make films as well, and I can tell you that you could make a story in about 3 words. You could say, I felt hungry, and immediately I've created a bunch of information for you in your mind. And now if I wanted to build on that and to give you more information about it, because your curiosity might start kicking in about, well, why was I hungry? You know, I could then start to say, well, because I've been working so hard, I didn't have time to eat. And gradually you can build up a more and more complex picture. And this is how dramatic tension works in films. And it's how we learn. It's how we tell stories to each other, which is what Brecht was talking about. And it's really, I think, how we engage with the world, how we actually apprehend information, digest that information, and either put it in our long-term memory or medium-term memory or not. And there's a process of assessment that goes on unconsciously where we decide whether the information's worth remembering or not. So what I wanted to do was create a training system where my students were not bored, they were not working hard. Learning is actually very hard work because your brain's firing off creating all these neural networks, and that's actually really tiring, much more tiring than teaching. So I wanted to create a system where it was easy, where it really just felt like I was having a conversation with my students and they were obtaining all of the learning I wanted them to receive without it being work, just being a completely natural, organic, intuitive flow of ideas. And I started studying the subject. I believe the word is pedagogy. This is the subject of teaching and learning, ontology, all these ologies. And I gradually built up a picture in my mind of how a human being learns. And what I found was that most standard training systems are completely at odds with the way that people learn. Just doesn't work. So my training system hopefully is a bit more in tune with the actual human beings that you're talking to. And of course, the rules of engagement in this system apply to any form of human interaction. So they apply to any communication skills, management, presentations, training. But I'm really just focusing on training to begin with. And I will, for example, it's your unconscious mind that actually does the learning. Your conscious mind very often just gets in the way of your unconscious mind doing its job. And if you think about it, it's your unconscious mind that creates the connections between the ideas that you're thinking about right now and the memories that you have. It throws them up for you. It finds these correspondences. And it's your unconscious mind that selects the learning and creates the memories. So why bother with talking to the conscious mind? The conscious mind is, as the existentialists would say, the passenger. And it gets in the way by sticking its nose in and interfering with its critical faculties. The consciousness seems to work in a very linear way. very interested in this division, which may be an imaginary one, between consciousness and the unconscious mind. But if you can find ways of distracting the conscious mind and just talk directly to the unconscious minds of your students, it's an incredibly efficient way of teaching. Of course, how do you distract the conscious mind? Well, the trick to that is to keep it interested. And consciousness, most human consciousness, seems to be, as I said, quite linear, and so and likes a good story. So one of the things that I will regularly do as a teacher is make up any story at all, any story whatsoever, and pin the ideas that I'm teaching onto that story. So it could be, for example, I used to have to teach an incredibly boring subject when I was working for 3Com, a thing called S registers, which is a way that some computer systems register information using binary. You see, you've already gone to sleep already.
I'm joking.
So what I used to do is I used to say, well, okay, look, you know, we've got a coffee machine downstairs. And when you use the coffee machine, you press this button for coffee, this button for milk, this button for sugar, this button for strong coffee, this button for a lot of sugar. And effectively, that's what that has a computer using S registers in it. So I'd build the ideas into the most immediately relevant story I could come up with. It doesn't have to be laser beams and robots. It could just be, you know, but what you need to do is keep it funny. You need to keep people relaxed. There are certain obstacles to learning. Tension, for example, is or anxiety actually interferes with the process of creating neural pathways in your brain. So if you've got tense students, it just doesn't work. So for that reason, I continually make rubbish jokes while I'm teaching. Not because I think they're funny, but because it just breaks down people's inhibitions. They think, look at this guy, he's teaching us, he really knows what he's talking about, but what an idiot. And they're not tense anymore. They don't feel threatened. They don't feel shy in front of me as a teacher or each other. And you know when it's working, when people start contributing their own jokes, you know. Another big obstacle to learning is familiarity. People have to have some kind of connection with the information you're giving them. And I remember when I first read about this, it was described as trying to build a clay statue. You have your skeleton, the framework, inside the statue, and you piece bits of clay on top. And you'll layer the clay up and build it up so that eventually you've got a large enough sculpture for you to do your fine finishing on. It's very much like that with learning. You need that skeleton, or you need the coat hooks, or whatever analogy it is that you want. You've got to have somewhere to put the information. But one of the things that I discovered when I was researching and preparing this unique training system, which frankly isn't that unique, it's just a good combination of existing ideas really, is that anything will do. If you don't have a skeleton in place, if you don't have a set of ideas to connect new ideas with, I can just make one up. And humans have this tremendous affinity with stories and patterns. And so the three key elements of the training system are empathy, because as a trainer, you have to have a very, very strong empathetic bond with your students. Stories, because, you know, as a species, we seem to have developed the written word very late relative to our language, the complexities of our language. And it seems to be because we never bothered writing anything down. We had stories instead. You might have heard of the tarot, which were a pictorial system for teaching and was later used as a form of divination. They were reminders, if you like. They didn't bother with the words initially. And so stories, for whatever reason it is, we have this great connection with stories. And the third item is patterns, because we are a pattern-finding animal, which probably relates to the way that we connect with stories. So you'll have so the whole thing in my system is about getting a good empathy bond with your students, telling funny stories, or in fact any story, and creating patterns, identifying patterns. So if I'm teaching a technical subject, I would avoid talking about the technology. Instead, I'll talk about the principles. So if I'm talking about video technology, I'll begin by saying, okay, light hits your eye. And when light hits your eye, it does this stuff to your eye. And what's light anyway? And gradually you build up from these fundamental principles into ever more complex expressions of those principles. So it's vaguely reminiscent of chaos theory, except that chaos, you know, and fractals and these sort of ideas, they're kind of just setting in motion a principle. What we want to do is talk about, for example, if you're going to bake a cake, well, you're going to have to make it hot. And, you know, we can talk later about the precise temperature and what the different temperatures do. But let's just agree right now that baking involves making things hot. And if you're going to make things hot, what are the issues? And then, you know, we'll look at, well, when you make things hot, what does it do to them? And gradually you build up and build up and build up. And what I find by working that way, rather than, which some people do, is they teach you certain skills without understanding how you're doing them. And you use the skills and then they add in the detail later. Now that's an option too. But the problem with that is that you end up with a lot of question marks for your unconscious. Your unconscious mind wants to have everything sewn up. It wants to have nicely pigeonholed understandings. This means this, that means that. Thank you very much. Good night. When you teach that way, where you're giving just methods without clear understandings, it creates tension for the unconscious mind, because it's building up this buffer of stuff, and eventually it'll reach a point where it says, you know, I just don't care. I don't get it, and I don't care. I'm not going to learn anymore today. By coming from the other direction, people have that understanding continually. And I find that this method allows people to self-train much, much more, which is kind of bad for trainers, I know, because we get less work. But, you know, it's like, if you're a trainer, you want to teach people to be able to learn as well as just teaching them. If you're a doctor, it's not, you know, you wouldn't be a very good doctor if you were continually wanting people to be not particularly good at staying well so that you get more work. It doesn't work, at least not morally. So as a trainer, my job is to make people not need me. So I find that this method allows people to self-train. I usually spend a bit of time teaching people how to learn in all the classes that I teach. And I find that the knowledge retention is significantly higher. Now, I've never really studied this because it's quite difficult to get statistics. But I would say that particularly, I mean, this training method is applicable to everything from teaching people how to be care workers to building engines. But I tended to teach technical subjects, which are really, really challenging, complex subjects. And with a technical subject, you might expect to get maybe 20% knowledge retention would be pretty reasonable. That's what you'd expect. And the rest is reading notes. And I reckon I get at least 50 with this system, and sometimes 80%. And for anybody to be able to teach a complex technical subject and have their students come away with 80% knowledge retention, I mean, I give myself a gold star every time.
That is an amazing percentage, definitely. And what I mean, I'd love to be a student when you were teaching, Maxim.
I'd just teach you all the wrong stuff, though.
You probably would. I've got a funny feeling. No, I suppose for people who need to know your credibility, because you seem to have a great empathy with your students. I suppose you need that as a teacher as well. So what is your background in regards to teaching? Who have you taught in the past?
Okay, good question. Where to start? Well, I used to do technical support. I was taught how to give support on the phone. I had telephone training. And it's all about, you know, you can tell when someone's smiling on the phone or not. You can tell a lot about their body language. They say that 90% of communication is nonverbal. But even on the telephone, something like, I forget what the figure is now. Someone will probably be able to tell me. It's like still a massive proportion of communication by telephone is nonverbal. And by verbal, I mean words. So you can make noises. You know, that counts as nonverbal for me. But I learned about a little bit about human interaction there. But then I've totally learned it in the battlefield of customer services. I learned how to control the call, how to deal with angry customers. And then later, when I was working in, I got to a point where I was doing second or third level technical support for a big IT company. And by the time people get to third level support, they may already be drunk on the bottle of vodka that they've opened because they can't stand the problem anymore. The computer's trying to kill them. I got invited to lunch by an author. I got sent a book by an author because I got her computer working. I was invited to meet the daughter of another author. And one of the things I learned, for example, is I learned to develop my George Clooney doctor's voice. So people would come through and I'd say, hello, tell me where the problem is. It's okay. Everything's going to be fine. You just sit back. I'm going to make it work. And if I can't make it work, I'm going to come over there and make you a cup of tea. And you just learn to relax people. I found with partly from studying it and partly just from an interest in psychology, I found that there's the very interesting branch of psychology called neurolinguistic programming thing. And I'm not an NLP expert. I just read about it a bit. When they created NLP as an idea, they created it because they filmed various psychologists, various psychiatrists who were using the same systems of psychiatry, but having varying results. And they argued, well, there has to be something going on. If you're having varying levels of success with clients, but using the same system, there's got to be something else. It can't be the system. And what they found almost invariably was that the positive results were a product of good empathy. And consciously or unconsciously, the successful psychiatrists were they were building a very strong empathetic bond very quickly with their clients. And it would be right down to things like breathing patterns and the phrases that you use, the emphasis you place on words. So one of the first things that I suggest for trainers is that, for example, that they ask very, very simple questions that they know their students will know the answers to. Not because they want to know the answers, but because they want to observe the positive, affirmative, non-verbal signals. So when you say to somebody, how do you get to work? And they go, oh, I get the bus. What they're giving you is the positive signal. I get it. I understand. Here's my answer. And then I'll ask them a few more complex questions where hopefully I'll get the negative non-verbal body language. So I go, okay, make a little mental note. So then when I'm teaching a subject later on, I can watch the class and see without them telling me, those three guys have got it, those two haven't, you know, and I don't, and I know then I can, and I can also tell by watching their body language which bit of what I'm saying isn't making sense. So I can re-emphasize it. And what's interesting as a trainer, as a teacher, is if you totally immediately repeat what you just said, like almost exactly word for word, because people zone out, you know, it's a rhythm that people have. About one in five sentences they just don't hear because they're zoning out. If you just repeat what you said, they don't notice. They do notice if they were listening and they took it in. But obviously, if you're watching their body language, you can see, well, actually, I don't think they got that. I'm just going to say the whole thing again. And this time they get it and they tune in. And nobody ever says, why did you just repeat yourself? Or, yeah, we know. Because they're, you know, because, but that only works if you've got a strong bond, if you've understood them. So yes, I think empathy is incredibly important. And it's something that you can achieve by observation, or in a larger group, you can set up the rules of engagement.
What for you has made you think that this, what you've come up with, is one of the best type of training systems?
Oh, that's a good question. Actually, I just thought I was a pretty reasonable trainer. You know, when you finish training, you give these feedback forms out. And of course, you're standing over the students while they put 5 out of 5 for everything you do. Of course, they're going to. So when I started up my training company, one of the first things I did is I created a feedback bit of the website so that, and even though it's my company, I tend to pretend it isn't. I'll go on site. The people that I'm teaching may not know that I was the one that took the booking. And, you know, we have freelancers as well that do training for us, but it's very often me doing the training, small company. And one of the first things I did was create an online feedback form that people could fill in after I'd gone. So, because what's the point of me having feedback that I'm just watching them while they write, he was a bit rubbish. I mean, no, he wasn't rubbish. I had an absolutely awful training experience a while back, which was just bad in every way. And I knew that the guys I was training weren't happy. And I have my reasons for why the training didn't go well. I'll perhaps tell you about it later. But they started to fill the forms in until they found out that I was going to be collecting them at the end. And then half of them just didn't finish filling them in. And I respect that, because I think that's better than them just putting in, well, you know, they're going to write reasonable stuff, rather than have that social tension of me saying, well, why did you write this? I'm going to kick your ass now for writing that. But the real turning point, and you know, and I found that I was getting very, very good feedback, really, really good feedback from people, really out there, you know, wow, you know, that was amazing feedback. But the real turning point for me is that I have a friend who's a technical trainer in a big IT company in London, and he was visiting, and he was saying, and I get hired a lot as a stage presenter as well, and he was saying, well, you know, why do they, you know, they pay you so much money, why do they want you to do the stage presentation? Surely they could get anybody. Tell me your method. In fact, he said, tell me about how you teach. What is it that you do when you teach? So we spent about an hour with me talking about what I do. And at the end of an hour, he said, well, you've just taught me more in an hour than we learned from a company who charged us loads of money to come in and spend 3 days with us teaching us how to teach better. And frankly, they were rubbish. And, you know, you've just given me so much stuff to work with as a teacher. It's incredible. Why don't you teach that? And it was that conversation that led to me thinking, well, you know, yeah, I could, you know. I want to start by teaching how to teach. Then I'll start running, I may do already presentation skills, how to present to a group, maybe to a boardroom or to an audience. I'm most proud that I managed to get an audience in Sheffield to do a Mexican wave for me. I was really proud of that. You know, a Sheffield audience is not an easy audience, and it took a bit of warming them up, but they did in the end. So there'll be presentation skills. And then ultimately, my plan is to run a course which I will entitle How to Be. And the How to Be course is for primarily for organizations, businesses, where you have management and you have staff. And it'll be two separate courses in one. One will be for the staff and one will be for the management. And it's all about, you know, you probably spend more of your waking hours at work than anywhere else. So you might as well get something from it. You might as well feel pride. You might as well have authenticity and integrity and feel that what you're doing is contributing in some way. And as a management, how do you get people to feel committed and involved and engaged in what you're doing?
What are the major problems that people are having in terms of learning? Clearly, there's the idea of being engaging or getting the right thing out of your students. But what are the problems that you're tackling in your training trainer-trainers course?
I think there are different phases of challenge. I mean, you've got some really obvious ones. Like, you know, one of the things I do is I have an ongoing learning agreement with my students. So we might have an agenda when we arrive, but we'll talk about it at the beginning of the class. And if I feel that I've got a group of really competent, intelligent, focused students, and actually teachers tend to be very good students, I might increase the amount that we're going to cover that day. If I feel that the people are less qualified, like, you know, I'll very often teach a technical subject which has entry requirements. And it's rare that people have the entry requirements. You don't find out until you turn up. So you get there and say, okay, for example, you know, I presume I might be teaching an editing system, video editing system. And I presume that you know about timecode and video technology. And they look at you blankly and go, no. And you realize, okay, it's going to be a long haul. And I remember once teaching somebody how to use a computer, and they literally picked up the mouse and asked me what to do with it. And, you know, it's going to be a long haul. I teach Tai Chi as well, you know, and you'll get people who, the opposite end of the scale is that you'll get people who know a subject very well or think they do, and it makes them not want to listen to what you say. They don't respect you enough. You might have noises outside. You know, if there's building works going on and the noise is coming into the room, I would not fall short. I mean, I would not be shy of cutting the training down to half if there was a lot of disturbances, because people need a continuous unbroken line of focused attention to build up the ideas and to build up their understanding. If they're continually distracted, they just can't create that kind of network of memories, that network of understandings. Just to go back to the issue of people who know stuff already, you know, there is a solution to that. You have to show them that you're worth learning from. You have to have the respect of your students. I usually temper that, though, because if you have too much respect, shy students will be intimidated by you and arrogant students will resent you. I mean, that's a massive generalization, but that can happen. So what I generally do is I'll reel off my CV. You know, first of all, I'll ask all about the individual students. That allows me to get a pretty good idea of how to empathize with the students. And then I'll say, okay, well, let me tell you why you should learn from me. And I'll give them a bit of my background, which on paper sounds dead impressive. You know, most of it was blagged jobs and lucky opportunities, lucky breaks. But it sounds quite impressive on paper. As soon as I can see, everyone in the room is giving me the, wow, you're quite impressive body language, you know, whoa, this guy really knows his stuff. As soon as I see that in everybody, I tell an absolutely awful joke, or I show that I'm utterly useless at something. I can't draw, for example. Absolutely terrible. And I'm rubbish on a dance floor. That way people go, oh, okay, he's really, really knowledgeable about what he's teaching us, but he's a human being as well. And that way they're not intimidated, they're not threatened, you know, it's not a problem. You get, I mean, some of the things that I think trainers forget about when they're teaching is some really, really basic stuff. If you have a late night, and you're tired the next day, it will be harder for your brain to create memories. That's not psychology. That's not anything spiritual, emotional, or anything like that. Your brain will have harder time creating the memories because you'll be tired the next day. If you have a big lunch, after lunch, you can see it. It's about 2 hours after lunch. If anyone has a big lunch, they're ready for sleep. So what I generally say is, look, please have a small lunch. You know, have a salad, have a sandwich and a coffee. Please do not have a big steak and ale pie with, you know, loads of chips and gravy and onion rings and a big milkshake. Please don't do that, because if you do, I know that an hour and a half to 2 hours after you get back, I might as well just be singing a song. You're not going to remember what I'm telling you. I know you won't, because all the blood is in your digestive system. It's all going through your pancreas and your stomach, and you know, it's not in your head, and you need a nap. So again, if people come back and I say, I'll say nicely, oh, hi, what did you have for lunch? Oh, I had a big steak and ale pie and chips. Immediately, in my mind, I'm striking stuff off the list of things I'm going to teach them. It's pointless. I'm not going, because they will not remember. So there are some simple biological things. Distractions. You might have a student who comes to a class with a disability, just one. Now, like I said earlier, people want explanations for things. It doesn't really matter what the explanation is. They just want the explanation. If I have a student, just one student, with some visible disability, like a wonky leg or a misshapen arm, or you might get someone who's blind in one eye and they don't cover it up with glasses, and sometimes when people have blindness, like, there's just nothing there, you know, it's just a black hole instead of an iris. One of the first things I'll say, and I'll wait till everyone's in the room, and I'll say, what happened to your leg? What happened to your eye? What happened to your arm? I tell you now, any mature adult who has a disability, they already got over it. No, you know, they either already got over it, or they're in an asylum, or, you know, they're getting care. Anybody that you meet who has a disability, who's prepared to go out in the street and meet people, they're over it. So they're fine. What's not fine is the other people in the class who, it's not that they have any issue with disabilities at all, but they're desperate to know what the cause is. They're dying to know what it is. And you're saying to them, okay, today I'm going to teach you this, this, and this. And what they're thinking is, the teacher's saying yada, yada, yada something. I wonder what happened to his arm. You know, oh, look at that. He's got some kind of sling on it. I wonder if it's, you know, his fingers are all bent up. You know, I wonder if that's thalidomide. I wonder if it's this. I wonder if it's that. Much, much better to say, what happened to your arm? And they go, oh, you know, it's this and that and the other. And then, or you can see it. Every single student in the class ticks a box. Okay, now I know what it is. They're not interested. They don't really care. It's just they got to know what it is. You might have someone who comes to the class and they've got, they had a car accident, a very, very minor car accident on the way, bent up their bumper a little bit or something. And, you know, they come in and they'll usually say, oh, you know, I had a bit of an accident on the way in. I will generally not let them talk about it straight away. I have to be the person. When I say something, people listen. When I ask a question, people answer it. And I very gently reassert that all the time. But once everyone's settled, I'll say something, oh, you know, that's terrible. Anyway, you know, are you okay? We'll get on. I'll wait till everybody is sitting down. And then I'll find some excuse to be distracted. I'll say, oh, let me just get my papers together. And I'll say, while I'm doing this, what happened on your accident? So I'm giving them permission to talk about it. I'm not letting them control the class. I'm not letting them control the room. I'm giving them permission for 4 or 5 minutes to get it out of their system. Because if I don't, they are not going to be able to concentrate on anything I say for the whole morning. The whole morning they're going to be like, oh, if only I'd said this and the traffic warden did that. And, oh, what am I going to do about my bumper? Let them get it out. It's like an energy charge. They have to get it out of their system. But I don't want to let them control the class. So lots of different things.
Ah, so next time I go into some sort of training scheme, I'm going to remember to keep calm. I'll be asked soon. If they're a good trainer, right?
Don't keep calm. Get it out of your system.
And I mean, your training is known for it being fun, and that's not for the needless sake of being fun. Clearly, you've thought about that very carefully. Mm. What for you is the emphasis of fun? How does that help you with your training?
I think, you know, no matter where you go, humour turns up. I just think humour is really, really important. You know, there's something unique about the human ability to to have a joke, to detect comedy. And whatever that thing is, it's profoundly important. And humor does amazing things to your brain. It produces all kinds of endorphins, great stuff. You know, it's kind of like being in love. Like, if you laugh a lot, it's kind of like being in love. It produces all sorts of happy drugs in your head. Mild doses of, I think it's called oxytocin. It's like the most addictive chemical in the world. Your brain produces it at real ecstatic, happy times. So you get good feelings in your brain and in your body, because they're gradually more and more neural science is realizing that the brain isn't just sitting there in your head. It's actually a mixture of stuff going on with your body. There's all sorts of interaction going on with your body. When people laugh, they relax. And they need to relax in order to not have that obstacle, that anxiety that prevents them from learning. But the other good thing about laughter is that it successfully totally distracts you. While you're in the middle of laughing, all you are doing is laughing. And one of the things I learned from my kind of research and preparations of the system that I now employ is that your unconscious mind needs a certain amount of time to create memories at a biological level. And you've got a buffer. There's a certain amount of information you can take in. And then when that information reaches saturation point, your brain just discards stuff. You know, it's like, oh, well, that wasn't very interesting. I'll dump that. And that wasn't interesting. I'll dump that. You need to give, what I could do is I give people a big fat packet of information. And then I wait till everybody's got it, and then I talk about something totally different. And I do it until I see everyone look relaxed. And then I go back to more technical stuff. And then I relax them. And then more technical. And then I relax them. More technical. And I alternate this way. The great thing about a joke is that it successfully, utterly distracts the conscious mind. And sometimes you can just dip in at the end, just dash in at the end with a bit more technical information. So you can say, you know, yada, 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 technology, or even, you know, if you're learning CPR, if you're learning, you know, first aid techniques, you know, don't forget it's this many breaths. Oh, that reminds me. And then I'll talk about some ridiculous story or some Groucho Marx quote or something. And then I'll say, just as they're all finishing laughing, I'll say, okay, so it's 2 breaths, 30 compressions. And that way it's just reaffirmed what I told them a moment ago, which re-imprints the memory. And the unconscious mind gets that little like, oh yeah, he's still talking about the same thing. Right, okay, CPR, fine. And it's about re-imprinting the memories in a happy, positive way. The unconscious mind does not deal well with negatives. It tends to work much better with positives. It's better to phrase things in positives. But it's about distracting people. So you give them this technical stuff, distract them with a joke, then maybe move on to a little story, and then ask them questions. And students discover that they know stuff. They discover that they're remembering things that they already know, that they didn't know 5 minutes ago.
And would you say that's an unnatural or a natural way of learning?
It's how we learn. It's absolutely the most natural way to learn. You know, the fact is that when you're teaching, you feel like changing the subject. Like you'll teach a technical thing, or some, you know, specific bit of information, like customer service even, you know. Don't forget, do this, yada, 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 do that. You want to change the subject because you're bored with what you've just said. Bored is the wrong word, you know. It has a life cycle. The focus, if you have a good empathetic bond with your students, that cycle of attentive, inattentive, attentive, inattentive, you're all going to be in tune with each other. So you watch that and monitor it. The truth is that you feel it as a teacher. You feel, okay, I've told them a bunch of stuff. I'd really like to talk about something totally different now. The difference with my system is I'm saying, do what feels natural. Change the subject. It could be that someone's like, you've got a cute new phone, right? And we were looking at it before we started. And I might well tell you something, whatever the subject is, I might give you a nice packet of information. And then as soon as I see that distant look in your eyes, which says, I'm making memories now, I'll say, so what's so good about that phone then? And I'll get you talking about the phone. And the reason I'm doing that is because it's natural and it makes you feel relaxed. It makes you feel natural. So that helps with the empathetic bond. It helps with all of that stuff. It also means that your unconscious mind has time to go away and write the memories. It's almost like a computer. And then when I feel, again, when I feel, it sounds very touchy-feely, but actually it is, but it's very much more, it's very logical as well. When I feel that we've done enough talking about nothing, I'll go back to the technical stuff again. And that's just the way we work. That's the difference. We're not forcing people to behave like machines.
That, or you ask me a question so you could buy yourself more time to figure out how to nick my phone.
Exactly. Look, is that an Aurora Borealis or am I a Dutchman?
See, it's true. I'm seeing through you. which I think, yeah, when I think about sort of me learning, that makes total sense. Mm. Absolutely total sense. And I think if in your system you're teaching a teacher, at the end of the day, there's a lot of teachers out there who know their subject very well. They just don't know how to communicate that well.
They don't know how to be natural.
That's it. So, I mean, your system is to do with communication generally. Uh-huh. What do you think the skills are that you're... What skills do you think you're giving to people that they can actually use in maybe everyday life or that are transferable?
Oh, it's great. I mean, a lot of this stuff, you know, the emphasis here is on teaching, because I think teaching is a profoundly important role in the world. And I really want to get that started. But just think about it. You know, imagine how much better you could communicate with people. So one of the little things, I've been writing the student handbook. It's going to be big. You know, all the students get a copy of this handbook. And I read recently a fantastically useful bit of information, just a great idea. When you meet people, let's say there are two ways that you can approach the whole idea of what it is to meet somebody. Option number one, which is the most commonly used version, is that I'm over here and you're over there, and what I show you, what I reveal to you about myself, is what you have to go on when you're working out who I am and what I'm about and how you feel about me and what our relationship is. And that... And then you reveal things to me, and I base all of my understandings on what you've revealed to me. So we're continually revealing stuff about ourselves, consciously and unconsciously. That model's great. It's very safe model, very kind of Western Europe model. You know, we're very, I'm over here, I'm protected, got my defense mechanisms up, that's all good. And of course, the problem with that is that it takes time to build a strong bond with people, because you've got to allow each other to be close instead of just being close. The other way of looking at it is quite spiritual, is that you approach all meetings from the perspective that we're all one. And now, it doesn't matter what your philosophy is, it doesn't matter whether you believe in this or agree with it or disagree with it, but if you just go with it as an idea, just imagine, it's a what if situation. What if the entire universe, you, me, this table, the microphone, the air we're breathing, we're all one. Then me meeting you is irrelevant. We're already one. So there's nothing for me to hide. There's nothing for me to reveal. There's nothing for you to judge, so there's nothing I should fear. And so we're already one being. We're already one entity. All that's happening that's new is how these two parts of us are interacting. So it's like my two hands interacting. They simply are. And it's fascinating. If you approach meetings that way, you realize that it's a thing called relational psychology. If you relate to somebody in a particular way, it's very, very hard for them not to reciprocate. So if you act like a parent, it's really hard for people not to act like kids around you, and vice versa. Relational psychology, they say, well, you should behave like an adult, and that encourages people to behave like an adult with you. So they just divide it into child, adult, parent. This idea of assuming that we're all one, there is no separation, makes it really hard for people not to relax with you, because you're totally relaxed. You're totally at peace. There's no threat. You don't feel threatened, and you don't feel threatening. You simply are with people. You'd be amazed what a difference it makes. And as a trainer, as a teacher, you are creating an atmosphere in your class as a teacher. So when you go in there with this attitude that your students are one with you already, it's just interesting to see what it's like interacting in this way and discovering things consciously about each other. It becomes play. It becomes exciting. You know, my consciousness may not perceive the oneness of all being, so it goes on a voyage of discovery and exploration. But that doesn't change it being the reality in this model. You know, I'm not going to argue whether it's true or not, but it's a very effective approach. So it's how you feel inside as a trainer changes the way that your students relate to you.
Okay, and clearly atmosphere for you is quite an important thing, especially since you're a... I'm thinking, what sort of teaching are you giving? and the atmosphere has obviously been an instrumental part of what you do as a filmmaker. We still are a filmmaker as well. So how has your filmmaking actually helped you to devise a system that you have and the uniqueness of it?
Only really in a very simple way, that I felt that as I mentioned earlier, that you need very, very little information to create. I believe in the inner world model, which was, I think, originally a sort of a bit existentialist, a bit psychological. It's this idea that you're not actually interacting with the world directly. The information your senses give you all feeds into a model of the world, and it's that you're interacting with. So dramatic tension in a movie works where you give information that suggests the world works one way, and then you contradict or confirm that later. That's dramatic tension. You see someone get out of a car in cowboy boots, you immediately have a picture of who they are, and that can be contradicted or confirmed. The inner world model, though, describes our entire relationship with reality. And as a teacher, I think that you can begin to see the way that you structure your courses, for example, the way that you provide information to your students in that model. And it makes you realize that you're just not providing enough connections. It makes you realize that you're not providing enough information or too much too soon. Sometimes you need to create curiosity in order for your students to want to know the answer. Making your students want what you've got to give is really important as a teacher.
And you've mentioned ESP before. What is the idea of ESP?
It was a bit of a fluke. It's just the first three letters, the first letters of the core components of the system: empathy, stories, and patterns. So it's just an easy way of remembering that those are always go back to those three. If you ever find yourself losing your thread a little bit when you're teaching, just go back a step. You know, have I still got a good bond with my students? Are my stories working? Have I given them enough clear patterns? Enough, you know, it's difficult to sum up why patterns are important in training. It's really about looking at any process, any set of ideas that you want to learn, not in terms of facts and figures, but in terms of principles. And so you look for patterns within any system that you're trying to teach. So it could be like, you know, how do you give an interview in a radio station? And there are certain things that you do, rather than looking at the individual components of that, which can all come later. You start off by looking at the overview. You know, what's happening here? What's the plot? And then you fill in the details later.
Okay. And some teachers, some trainers would claim that learning is actually harder than teaching. Why is that?
It just is. There you go. Next question.
It just is.
Learning requires effort. You know, I mean, I think that if you teach well, it is tiring. I mean, but it's tiring in a different way. It buzzes you up. You get really fully alive and fully awake when you're teaching well. But by the end of the day, honestly, I find I just need to sit quietly for 20 minutes, staring into space, and switch off, because I'm exerting myself in ways that we don't often need to. You know, you've got to be fully attentive to teach well, and that's tiring. But learning requires the creation of new neural pathways in your brain. It requires a level of focus and concentration. It's easier to speak than it is to listen to someone speaking. Listening is harder work than expressing yourself. And so I would always, that's why I give my students a lot of breaks. And I give them breaks by telling them stories or jokes or just 5 minutes away. I'll often say, okay, let's have a couple of minutes to stretch our legs. Not a proper coffee break, not a lunch break, just get away from this room, breathe some air, move your body, get your cardiovascular system going a little bit, and come back and we'll continue. And it allows you to pack a lot more into the day.
Now, you have a very positive outlook on everything, the way you teach,
except mornings.
You deal with it mornings. I can't believe that for a minute, but clearly you're saying you're not a morning person.
Oh, no.
But you must have had a really bad experience as a teacher once upon a time. Can you give us
Yeah, I mean, everyone, you know, everyone starts. I mean, I think the worst thing for a teacher is not to know what you're talking about. And it's okay not to know everything, but what it is, what you are going to talk about, you really need to know it. And they say there's this circle of knowledge. Whatever you're going to teach, you need the next circle out of understanding. And that's just being a professional teacher. You have to know your subject. And if you don't know your subject, you have to say, I don't know. It's a terrible mistake to assume that people won't see through your pretense at knowing what you're talking about. You know, if you start saying, yeah, I think that's the vertical stabilizer Erelon in the second 29-bit secondary algorithm, you know, they know you're making it up. They sense it. They can feel it. So absolutely knowing what you're talking about is important. And that was a lesson for me. You know, when I first started out teaching stuff, I really felt, in order to get the approval, the endorsement of my students, I really felt that I had to know everything. And it takes courage to admit that you're human and limited and you're just going to teach this. Students will often want you to teach extra stuff. If you know it, great. If you don't, say, look, I'm sorry, but I don't know. And that's a perfectly legitimate answer. But I know, I mean, every time you have a bad teaching experience, it teaches you something about teaching. And it's really interesting. For example, I've learned now to explain before the class, by the way, I have a different way of teaching, and I'm going to tell stories, and I'm going to tell jokes, and I'm going to veer off all the time. You just have to trust me that by the end of the day, you're going to really know what you're talking about better than you would do otherwise. Just trust me. And trust is an important factor in teaching. If I forget to make that announcement, I've had a couple of feedback forms from students saying he just kept veering off the subject. You know, the teacher seemed to have no attention whatsoever because he was veering off. The student never noticed that they actually knew the subject fantastically well at the end of the day, much better than they would have done if I just stuck to it. Oh yeah, so just the best and worst. The worst one was I had a group of students working on laptops. I went on to their workplace and I was sitting with them and they were working on laptops. And I, we did the training and it was all fine. And I discovered every now and then they would sort of phase out a little bit as I kind of noticed they just weren't really fully paying attention to me. And they were getting me to repeat stuff that I just covered. And then I noticed that every now and then one or other of them would start typing. And I'd be thinking, well, we're not doing anything that involves typing. I don't know why that is. And then one guy started talking really loudly. They were sharing a computer each. So one guy started talking so loudly to his colleague that I had to say, look, guys, you know, if you want to talk, that's completely fine. You know, it's important that you share information with each other. But can you just keep it down a bit because the other people in the class can't hear me? And the guy was quite moody with me and said, well, maybe if we understood the subject, you know, we wouldn't need to ask each other, you know. Okay, so he's telling me that I'm a really bad teacher and I haven't taught him. So I said, well, ask me, tell me, because maybe I haven't explained it very well. You know, tell me what it is and I'll re-explain it because perhaps other people in the class haven't got it either. And what he asked me was the exact thing I had just explained to the class. And it turned out that he hadn't heard me because he was doing his emails.
Ah, tut tut.
Now, of course, in my head, I did a kung fu kick straight across the class, took his head clean off of his shoulders. But outwardly, I just said, well, okay, pointed to another student in the class and said, you explain it, we've just covered it. I was so staggered by them paying me lots of money to come and teach them a subject and then totally ignoring me and doing their emails, I had no idea what to say. And it taught me the lesson of setting up the rules of engagement before the class. It was a very valuable lesson. Best experience, I think, was the Mexican wave.
That sounds like a great experience in itself to watch.
It was anyway. Great. 120 people in a cinema teaching them technical stuff about some Adobe software and managing to get them to Mexican Way for me. That was fun.
And finally, Maxim, that's been, I can see now why your trainer's course could be so beneficial. What for you, if people are listening out there and think, great, I really want to get involved, what one thing would you tell them to let them know that this system does work?
Goodness. I think that I make no apologies in this system that it's being created by experience, the personal direct experience. Like the samurai used to say that bad technique dies on the battlefield. And that's very much how this system's been developed. A lot of the techniques are not new. If you browse around the net, if you read all the books, you'll find this information. But for me, it's about distilling all of that and making it accessible for everybody. This isn't really for total beginners. You could read a book on beginning on training. This is for people who want to really develop their teaching techniques and just try it. I think, you know, the number one tip, or two tips I would give for trainers is, number one, be authentic. Always, always be authentic as a person with your students because they'll know when you're not. And number two, remember that you're there for the benefit of your students, not for the benefit of yourself. Your job is to facilitate them growing in whatever direction it is you're there to support. It's not about you looking cool. It's not about you impressing anybody. If you want to impress somebody, pay them. You know, it's not what you're there for. Authenticity and giving. Care, in fact.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Max and Jager, for joining us here on WCR 101.8 FM. And hopefully those of you who are thinking about getting into becoming a trainer, you should check out Maxim's website because it sounds fantastic. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you.